All right, and we're live. Welcome back to another episode of the Social Kick Podcast. I'm Brian Lundquist, joined by a full crew today, Luke Paddington, Dr. John Mullen, Justin Nguyen, and the darling of the 2016 Olympics, Olympic medalist, Uber medalist, NCAA champion, Maya Dorado Andrews. Thanks for coming on, Maya.
Yay!
Nice. Well, first of all, welcome. It's beer o'clock, at least for us, but what are you drinking tonight?
I am actually kind of out of character for me, also drinking a beer. We have a Fort Point KSA. It's one of the few beers that I enjoy.
Yeah, is that a Kolsch?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why is that out of character? What's normal for you?
I'm more of a wine drinker generally.
All right. Yeah. What kind of wine?
Brian gets so disappointed, by the way. Sorry. You're like, all right.
No, mostly red, of the red variety.
Charles Schott is.
Yeah.
Charles Schott.
There we go.
I would have expected someone who hails from wine country to be very specific about this.
Again, to your point, like that we were talking about earlier, you weren't an adult in Atlanta. Like I was never an adult in Sonoma County, so I'm having to like relearn the wine.
Yeah, understood. Fair enough. All right, Justin, what are you drinking tonight?
Well, I'm turning 26 this weekend, so as us millennials say, Luke, we get turned, get lit. I'm having Corona.
We get turned? I don't know that word.
Vocabulary, Luke.
I'd say millennials also rock gold microphones. Look at you. John, what are you drinking?
Yep, I'm back on the Scotch wagon. Have another Johnny Walker here. Oh, we had another birthday recently, though, right, Luke?
That's why I have all this leftover Modelo. I got all this Modelo for you guys when you came over. I didn't drink any of it. Brian brought his Budweiser, so I have Modelo going on right now. Good beer.
We did have a bunch of birthdays recently. I had a birthday recently, and speaking of said Budweiser, I'm drinking those. But I'm honestly in fridge emptying mode tonight because I literally had two in my fridge, and if I drink one later, it's going to be a Stella. But that's number two. Anyway, okay, so swim talk. Maya, we wanted to talk about your experience in Rio, but the thing that stuck out a lot, I think, for many of us, especially those from afar who didn't know you personally and didn't see the progression up close, was showing up to trials, dominating, showing up to the Olympics, and frankly, not upsetting in terms of medals, but I mean, winning Olympic gold and what I think a lot of people would consider an upset. I wanted to ask you, did you think it was an upset or did you know that you were going to win that race?
No, 100% thought it was an upset. I was not expecting to win that. I think my reaction was pretty candid in terms of what I was expecting to have happen. It was actually funny because the morning of the race, right? So it's like prelims in the morning, semis at night, and then you have the next morning off and then some finals that next night. And so the morning of the Trinidad backstroke, I was at the warm-up pool with, I think, like Leah Smith and Kathleen Baker, and because they had also had a morning off, and you know, we were joking around and just kind of getting our loosen in, and they were saying, you know, if you win tonight, you have to sit on the lane line, and that has to be your celebration. And I was like, absolutely not. Like, even though I did not think there was a chance that I was going to win, there was no way I was going to promise to do.
Leah said you said you would.
She ended up kissing me to do it. And I said, yes. I was like, okay, fine. Thinking that there was no chance at all that I was going to win. So I agreed to this. And then it actually went through my mind. So, you know, I touch the wall, see the total shock, try to process. And then truly the thought popped into my head of like, oh my gosh, does this mean I have to sit on the lane? I was like, no, I can't do it. It'd be too stupid. So no, it was a total shock.
Well, there's something. So I actually really appreciate it. Now, granted, I swam in college with Cesar Cielo, who turned a lot of people off by his like loud celebrations years ago. And I think that gave a bad taste for a lot of people. But I have to say, I really appreciate a champion who celebrates. And for whatever reason, like, that's why I don't really care for Roger Federer, because he just a quiet champion. And I just want somebody who's like really proud of it. So I don't know. I like the sitting on the landline thing, but I wanted to ask, so if that was a shock to you and that was an upset, are there any other upsets in Olympic history that stand out to you as just being like, whoa, I did not expect that to happen?
Yeah, I mean, like, it's cliche for a reason, but you cannot not mention the 400 free relay from 2008. So kind of like two experiences around that. First, I did a clinic with Jason Lezak maybe last year, I think. And I had never really met him before, you know, like seeing each other through various swimming things. And then we were doing clinic together and he brought his medal from that relay. And I've seen a lot of gold medals. Like, I've seen them from different years, all that stuff. But seeing that medal, holding it in my hand, I had this very weird physical reaction, like got goosebumps. Just that race was so incredible. And to see that medal like moved me in a way that most don't. And then, you know, recently, I think at the beginning of all this quarantining and sheltering in place, the NBC decided to rebroadcast, you know, all those years of the Olympics. And so sitting and watching Phelps's Beijing, you're just hit again with how insane that was. And I think as swimmers, we got used to it a little bit and we weren't fully appreciating that we were living in that era. But to watch it again and think about all the swims that he had, all of the world records that he set, is just unbelievable. And so it's the 400 free relay, which was absolutely crazy every single time you watch it. And then the 100 fly. Like, I remember watching that on tape delay at my friend's house in 2008 when we were in high school. And I didn't know it was going to happen, but her dad had seen the results online, came into the room as we were watching it. And, you know, at the 50, I'm like, oh man, that was such a good run. He was so close. You know, at the 75, I was saying that. And then he's like, watch this. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, there's no way that this spoiler is going to happen. And he does it. But it was still like, even though I had the spoiler, it was still like, I can't believe I just saw that. So they're cliche for a reason, but those two races are pretty hard to top, I think.
Yeah, I think they are. So, I mean, but you won four medals in Rio. Can you imagine what Michael was doing with all of the races, winning seven and seven gold, or eight and eight gold?
No, it's wild. Like, I had 2 days off the entire meet. I had the second day after the 400 IM, and then the very last day when all of that happens is the 50 and the mile and the 400 medley relay. And like,
we're 50 freestylers here. Not all of
it. Just, you know, the final. It's just the final. There's no morning. It's, you know, it's a light day. Let's be honest. It's a light day. But yeah, you're absolutely exhausted, and the drug testing and the media and the medal ceremonies, and it's just crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah, to really think about all of the swims that he had to do and the doubles and like the triples sometimes in a session, just bonkers.
That is absolutely nuts. Luke, what did you think was the biggest Olympic upset?
By the way, I wasn't a sprinter. I am a sprinter. Once a sprinter, always a sprinter. So Justin, correct that right now.
Clarify that, historian.
Yeah, that's true. You never go up. Like, distance swimmers swim down, but it's not like you're going to pick up the 800.
Yeah, we can't figure out why it's different between track and swimming. For some reason, in running, everybody goes up in triathlon. They go up in distance as they age. But in swimming, you just stop. You just stop coming to practice. You get out halfway through the main set, and then it's all over.
I stopped with John yesterday. We did some good 25s, John. The 25 butterfly yesterday was good.
My triceps are sore. First swim in 3 or 4 months. I can't lie. I'm feeling it.
Cool. You guys mentioned something, Maya. What you're saying and what you're talking about reminds me of some of races in history. I'm going to go back a bit to 88. So 88, I was 14 years old, right? And I was a big swimming nerd as a 14-year-old and really into swimming. And the Seoul Games were on, And we got all NBC coverage back in Trinidad. And so Matt Biondi was going to be breaking Spitz's record, right? So Matt Biondi was entered at, I don't know, 7-8 events, and he was trying to break Spitz's record. And the big swimmer in men's swimming that for up until then was Michael Gross. And I always remember Michael Gross because he was nicknamed the Albatross. And as a kid, I was like, somebody called the Albatross? What's that mean? You know, and you always want to swim like the Albatross. And he's just, you know, this West German superstar. And I remember in 84, he had a huge upset in lane six in his pet event, the 200 fly. He got beat by an Australian guy in 84. And I said, oh, well, poor fella. And he went over and he shook this guy's hand. And then 88 was his redemption. He was the, you know, 200 free gold medalist. And he it was him against Biondi, and it was the sweetest guy. And then he dove in the water, and Biondi took it out. And Biondi was under world record pace up to the 150. And then Gross made his move, and Gross came up on Biondi and head to head. And all of a sudden, next to Biondi on the other side, lane six, was a guy who was ranked 47th in the world, an Aussie guy that year, Duncan Armstrong. He just pulls ahead after riding Biondi's wave. And he's like, thank you. I swim the 400. I have gas in my tank. See ya, Matt. And he just went straight past Biondi, touched the wall, set the world record, 147.25. And his coach, he got on the lane rope. He sat in the lane rope. He punched. His coach, Laurie Lawrence, a crazy, crazy Aussie, kept shouting from the stands, lucky lane six, lucky lane six. Two Olympics in a row, and Aussie had beaten the West German. So that stood out. And in the same Olympics, the converse of what happened to Michael and Milo in we talked about, Maya. It was, we talked about this in a previous show. I'm from Trinidad, a swimmer born in Trinidad, raised in Suriname, Anthony Nesty. The way that I met him right off this gold medal as a 14-year-old, very, you know, as you said, you saw Jason's gold medal, seeing Anthony's gold medal in Trinidad afters, and having seen the race where Biondi was ahead. He was trying to break Spitz's record, and he was ahead at the 50 by a body length, at the 75, a body length, with 10 meters to go, half a body length. And Anthony just put his head down, just like Michael did. And he just did some very fast strokes and got to the wall before Biondi did. And I'll touch him by 1/100. And it was a really interesting his reaction, because Anthony was like, yeah, I'm going to get out the water. And in those days, he couldn't get over the touch pads, right? So the official was like, stop, stop. And he's like, ugh. And he's more pissed off at that. And then he kind of got out and kind of walked off. And then, and it was very humble. So those two races was just very meaningful in my career. So.
Love Nesty. He's the best.
Yeah. That's right. Biondi did have a long finish in that race. The some of the rules like that are kind of silly to me. The fact that you can't get out and you have to swim over to the side. I remember the first international meet finding that really nerve wracking, actually swimming on a relay that you had to swim over to the edge. And it's like, I don't get this. This rule doesn't make any sense to me.
No.
And we used to be able to false start. So you used to allow two false starts. So you would purposely false start to outsock your opponent. And then you slowly swim your way, come out.
Back to this talk.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, it's crazy. John, what's the biggest Olympic upset in your mind?
Well, I just want to clarify, because I think you guys, you're naming probably better races. Like, I'll never forget. I could watch the relay Maya mentioned, and I know what happens. I've seen it so many times, but I still can barely believe that Lizak is going to catch him every time I even watch it on replay. Yeah. So those are great races. But in my opinion, the biggest upset is also, I believe, a lucky lane six. Luke, you can correct me. And also a Stanford grad, Misty Hyman. And that's why. Because, I mean, so I was 14. Also, Luke, you said you were 14. I was 14 in 2000. So this is one of the first main races I remember. And all the hype at Sydney, Susie O'Neill, Madam Butterfly, home crowd, Misty Hyman, fly and die all day, all night. But what did she do at that 200 fly? She went out and she held on. And I'll never forget just being at my home in Ohio, standing and cheering for her and going nuts on the U.S. Olympic train. And I just couldn't believe that she won, just based off of, you know, what I knew at that time about her past and how, you know, she had to transition from going 45 meters underwater to them taking away the dolphin kicks. So she's had to be, and obviously she was a great swimmer and a great surface swimmer, but she was known for underwaters. Then they made that transition. She had to get better on the water. And she did it, and she upset Susie O'Neill, who won, didn't lose a race for so many years in a row, let alone to do it in Sydney. I think, yeah, the biggest upset that I remember, and I still get goosebumps thinking about that race. That was awesome.
She did it with such class too, John. I was in Sydney for those games.
Oh, yeah.
And her teammate, another Stanford alum, Siobhan Cropper, was from Trinidad. So I remember partying with Misty and Siobhan afterwards. And Misty was just like, just happy and content. She wasn't like, her ego wasn't flown up. She was just content. And it's like, yeah, we're good. That was cool. Thank you. I appreciate it. And I really was, you know, respect, much respect to that.
Yeah.
Brian, what do you have?
Well, so I know it's cliche, but I'm going to tell a little bit of a different story about that 08 relay because so I was training partners with Fred Biscay at the time, who was on the French team. And so going and granted, like I was trying to make the U.S. Olympic team. I did final in the 50 free at trials that year. I did not have a good trials overall, though. And I remember having like that 08 and 09 season were the prime of my career. And so I remember, you know, imagining myself in the lead up to trials being on that team. And yet when the team got picked, and I mean, I wasn't close in the 100 free, but I was in semifinals. No, I wasn't even in that. But I remember just knowing the guys on both sides reasonably well, because whether my training partners or coaches were directly working with some of the guys on the French team, even former coaches at Auburn were coaching. A guy named Romy Barnier was coaching Fabian Gillo. And so, like, I kind of had a connection to a lot of the folks on either side. And leading up to that, Bernard was trading world records with Eamon Sullivan earlier in the season, like clear favorite in the 100 freestyle along with Eamon, but nobody in the U.S. was really matching it. Phelps went 47.5 at U.S. trials, or 47.7 in prelims and tapped out.
Yeah,
and said, okay, I've done my work here to earn my spot on this relay. But then it was, you know, Lizak and Webergale trading, and then, you know, Cullen wasn't, you know, I mean, he was very good at that time, but he was like a clear fourth. But on paper, Irouty even says this in the coverage, but it was most certainly on paper a very clear advantage for the French team. And I didn't expect this at the time because Fred was mostly a 50 freestyler in his history. He was better at the 50, but he went 46.6 in prelims. I mean, that was the fastest split in history. He went 46.6 again in finals.
Yeah.
At the third leg, that was again the fastest split in history, leading into the anchor leg in which he was handing off to the current world record holder and the guy who was dominating the 100 free that year. Yeah. So with the lead that they had, with the lead up to that, I thought even in that moment, like everyone who was watching that race live, and I do remember that a lot, those Olympics where you're watching where your teammates are in it is just so different. I mean, you were able to be there competing in the pool, but I would imagine even so this year, coming into this Olympic cycle and even next year, there will be people that you've spent time in the pool with, Maya, that you have such a close connection with, and you feel like you're on the pool deck. And that's what that race was like for me, where I was like competing with Webergale and Cullen in the US and then like swimming in the training pool with Fred and going, all right, like I honestly wanted the French team to win. This is so weird to me, but like that was my teammate. And, you know, and then, but it obviously worked out how it worked out. Lesson for sure in drafting is real. Like you can draft in a pool. It was a better race, but I do think that was a huge upset too, John. Okay. We're going to switch gears and come back to what was your last race, Maya?
It was the Turner Back Show.
Right.
Okay. That was it. And you're, that and you're,
it. That was it.
What a great mic drop.
Yeah, I was about to say.
Wasn't planned that way, but yeah.
And you haven't
warmed down. Like,
you didn't warm down. You just took your cap off, dropped it down.
Like, done.
Got the medal. Good to go. Like you said, mic drop.
And when you say it wasn't planned that way, what do you mean?
Oh, just it was certainly planned that I was going to stop after that. It was not planned that it was going to be such a great ending, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you talk, do you, you knew it was gonna be your last race before you swam, right? And mm-hmm. you know, the art of war, they always talk about it. It's good to know when you have your, is it good to know you have the back again, you know, you're back against the cliff, you got to fight the battle, you know, you fight a lot harder, or that's it, you don't fight as hard. I mean, do you think it helped knowing to you to relax? I mean, you look pretty relaxed beforehand, you look, but I don't know if you felt relaxed. Were you at ease, at peace? Like, did it help that knowing that this was it and you didn't care how you turned out, it was fine?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think there are some swimmers that, like Phelps would be one of them, that wants to feel mad and like wronged. And so I think in the relay, it was really helpful actually for the Americans that the French had, you know,
yeah,
done a little trash talking, and that like got them going. I am not that type of swimmer. And so for me, it was actually really great that I was done. It was like, whatever happens, it's okay. Like, I've made it to the Olympics. I've won a medal in every color already. Like, getting to be on the relay was something yeah. that was not expecting. And so that felt like a bonus. So, you know, kind of felt like playing with house money, as we would say sometimes. Like, I was just like, there's no way to screw this up, really. And so felt really at peace. And like, you know, the cliche of, you know, go have fun, like just have fun out there. And I was like, that I actually did. It was just genuinely fun to go through every stage of that day and that process of, you know, the ready room, the warm-ups, the going out there, you know, just yeah. being in all of it. It was just a really great time, and it was fun to do.
But you still very much planned that race. I mean, I'm sure you figured out what your splits were to be, what your goal time was to be. You had a strategy for that. And what was it before? We know what you went. We know what you did. What was it before?
Like my best time
before? No, what was your plan? What was your idea? Like, were you planning to go out in a 29, come back in a 31? You know, what were you thinking about doing? I'm just interested in your strategy.
That's okay. Another good question. So we, you know, with the Stanford team and with Greg, it's always kind of thinking about the progression through prelims, the semis, the finals as good, better, best. And so I've never in my life swum faster in the morning than I did at night. So I always just kind of had like a natural ramp up into my speed. And so like the morning swim of the 200 back was right after the night of the relay. So that felt like crap. Kind of getting the lactic acid out, just make sure that I got back for the night swimming. At night, see, it's a little bit fuzzy now, but you know, wanting to make sure that I was getting my tempo up at the beginning, just kind of like making sure that I was forcing that to set me up to have a good race. I never wanted to like build into the tempo. It had to be quick and light from the very beginning. Okay. And then something that we had worked on all season, basically for the past 2 years, was the third 50 and really making sure that that is where I made my move, because with my 400 IM base, like I was never going to die in a 200 backstroke. And there was just no, I didn't use my legs enough, honestly, because I'm not a very good kicker. So like there was no chance that I would die. So it was really about making sure that I hit the third 50 well enough to put myself in the position on the last one to like be in the race. And so finally, kind of by the final session, I really had that easy speed in the first 100 that only comes at the end of the season for me. And then had a good third 50, was lucky enough that like I flipped and saw Katinka next to me. And at that point, like I had actually kind of closed a little bit, on that 50. So I was like, oh, I'm closer than I thought. Not realizing obviously until after that I had gotten way farther behind off of that last wall. But in my mind, I was like, okay, you know, I'm kind of maybe catching up, getting a little bit closer. And then obviously that last 50 is just, you know, go to instinct, go to your training. I remember hearing the crowd getting louder and louder and trying to use that as like, maybe I'm catching up. I do remember thinking explicitly, this is the hardest my legs are ever going to have to work for the rest of my life. Like, this is it in this moment.
Nice.
And then I also think I was thinking like, she's more tired than I am, because she had had more races that meet. And then, you know, with 15 to go, it's just tempo, 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 and throw your head back and try to time it. And that was that.
Were you happiest with that race? Of, it sounds like a dumb question, but because you won gold, but was that the happiest race you've ever swam in your career? Or was it breaking the 200 IM high school record? Was it breaking, like what was, or winning NC's
on the relay at the Olympics? Yeah. Like you said, there's a lot of highlights.
Gold medal drop, mic drop, obviously, but you never know, right?
That's a great question, because that has sort of like become the race in, in my mind and my career. But let's see, I think it is the top, but in a very close, and it's actually kind of hard to say, but being on the relay at the Olympics was amazing. And it was even more amazing, I think, because I hadn't had the chance to really prepare for that or think it through. And so like that day after prelims, I got the text from Greg and it was like, "You're on tonight. Let's go." And
that was it? Just like that?
So that's obviously incredibly stressful.
Yeah.
And I was so nervous for that. Like, there's just a whole nother level of pressure when you could DQ a relay versus just making yourself look stupid. I was trying to be as cautious as possible on that start, and then just not mess it up for Katie. Really, it's nice to have Katie coming in behind you.
Do you remember what your relay split was? Do you remember what your takeoff was?
I think it was like 0.3.
Sounds maybe. About right for A3. Yeah.
That's good. Yeah. And not a sprinter, it was like safe enough. That race was just awesome. Yeah. And then to be able to be up on the podium with a gold medal with three other people that I adore was like, this is as good as it gets, I thought at that point.
Yeah. First gold medal, that's gotta be a great experience.
Yeah. And it just, you know, it means a little bit more when it's when you get to share it with your teammates. So I think that is like right there with the 200 back. And then it's got to be something from
Stanford.
2014 NCAAs for my senior year, when the meet just was like crazy good for Stanford top to bottom. And I'm sure, you know, with Felicia, like that was one of the best times I think we've had at some meet up to that point. So maybe like the medley relay, the 400 medley relay was pretty awesome. And then the 400 free relay to finish out that meet on a high note and get the win was just like, I can't believe we got to do this. And it felt like such a great way to end our Stanford career, which had, you know, had its ups and downs, but to kind of be able to leave on a high note and feel like the program had momentum, that Greg and Tracy were, you know, had it in good hands, was just a really special way to go out.
What do you think is one of the difficult things for people to transition from college swimming into being on the U.S. national team or an international team and coming from being fed off of a team environment to, you know, kind of in a more individual world, but still part of a team? Like you made that transition really well. Is there anything that you see that's really helpful for, you know, athletes that are trying to make that next bump up to the team?
Yeah, I think I would actually distinguish that between like college to pro, versus kind of going from the, you know, maybe like the WUGS level, the junior team level, and then taking that step up to sort of the A team with like a world champs. Because a lot of people while they're in college are making those big meets, but on the pro transition, like it is really, really hard. And I don't think people fully grasp it. I certainly hadn't expected it to be as hard as it was, but my senior year spring quarter was an absolute disaster. I cried at least once a week in practice, just like existential confusion. What am I doing here? Why do I want to swim? And then, you know, eventually kind of figure it out, but it's a total transition when you lose that team and you are swimming for yourself and to make money, which you haven't been before. And it just kind of creates a whole nother level of pressure and, stress around it. So it's tough to kind of get the right people around you and make sure that you're still doing it for the right reasons and kind of focus on what got you there in the first place. But I think people definitely underestimate that transition. But then going from Oh, sorry. What?
What do you think you did well in that transition?
I think I just like waited it out basically. So spring quarter was terrible, as I said. And then I remember having a conversation with Greg at Santa Clara in 2014, where I was having just an absolute dumpster fire of a meet. And he was like, do you want to do this or not? And we have enough time between right now and Pan Pax later this summer that you can salvage this, but like you need to turn it around right this instant if you want to do it. And
straight up.
You know, we all have to have those come to Jesus moments sometimes.
Yeah. What were you doing? Were you just loafing? Were you not showing up to practice on time? What was going on?
Yeah, I just could not get into it. I was like not working hard, just not feeling it. My heart wasn't in it. Because it took basically to like July, from March to July, to really figure out like, yeah, I want to do well. I think there's more that I can achieve in the sport. I want to see, you know, what more I'm capable of, and you know, just kind of get that motivation back. And so I think if you are expecting it to come really easily, it's going to be a lot harder. I think giving yourself time to work through that is helpful and make sure that you don't, you know, make any rash decisions too soon one way or another, can help. And then just having smart people in your life that know when to say like, you know, we're not going to get anything good out of you today. Just go home. Like, go do what you want to do this evening. And then, you know, at also times be like, get your shit together. You're being ridiculous. So I think having really good coaches and you know, people in my life also helped.
I was going to ask that. You seem very grounded and you seem very, at the same time, straight up, like, is it, you know, parents bring in your husband, obviously, you know, and your coaches. Yeah. And you've had about two main coaches in your career, Santa Rosa coach and Stanford coach mainly.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. That's very kind. Yeah, I had great parents that always stressed, you know, it's not about where you are relative to other people around you. Like, if you win your race, great. But if it wasn't your best effort, then that's not really what we're trying to do here. And if you came in last in your heat, but it was awesome, like celebrating kind of my own achievement, which I think is a really great way to get people through age group swimming. I had a really awesome club coach at the Santa Rosa Neptunes, Dan Greaves, who is a total bro. I mean, bro is the wrong word. Like he's great, but he's just very chill and does not take himself too seriously. Just make sure that swimming is really fun. And, you know, we work hard, but we don't think that we're curing cancer or saving the world. It's just swimming. And so I think that was also a great perspective to have.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, huge points that you're making, because you look at it on paper, you say, okay, Maya, great high school swimmer, went to Stanford, did great things there, then went on the Olympics, had a great, obviously, Olympics in 16. And then, I mean, the story at the Olympics was, okay, she's got her next stage figured out here. But obviously, there's a lot of ups and downs along the way. So I think for all the young swimmers listening and people, I mean, nothing is as good as it looks on paper.
Yeah, for sure. And I can kind of, you know, when people pop up onto your radar, you know, when they're having a great moment, it can kind of feel like they were always there, but, you know, you weren't hearing about them for that long because great things weren't necessarily happening. But you kind of just have to, you know, work in the dark for a while and enjoy.
What do you feel like it was a career low for you? Do you have one? Or was there a turning point where it just, you know, things weren't clicking?
Yeah, was it Santa Clara 2014 like you were talking about?
That was definitely a low point. But I think another spot that might have been was, you know, like 2012 Olympic trials, where Stanford didn't put anybody on the team. I didn't go any best times. I thought that was going to be my last Olympic trials. I kind of, it wasn't necessarily like a terrible meet. I got fourth in two events, but I think I kind of was like, you know, that's all I got. That's maybe going to be the peak of my swimming career. And I think that's a low point in that was almost like what it was for me. And then, you know, got really lucky with having Greg and Tracy come in and kind of, you know, that's definitely 2012
was sort of the pivot point in my swimming career. And then, you know, 2013 made my first big team with going to world championships and got some good experience there. And I think it really took off from there.
For, you know, for a long time, what you did in terms of mic drop, see ya, I'm on to the next thing, was the way that people did things, because nobody swam, you know, for their professional careers were like not really a thing. There was no money. There's still not that much money, but there's more opportunities, you know, and I think the world of social media and the media world in general does open up some other opportunities for athletes today, frankly. Mm-hmm. What do you think about the prospects of professional swimming today? And there's a lot of people, I'm sure your peers too, who are continuing to do it. There's people who are a lot older than you too that are still swimming and doing their thing. I mean, I'm curious to get your take on things like, you know, the ISL, like the landscape of pro swimming. Was that a consideration for you at all? And that kind of stuff? Or where do you sit?
They're going to come back like Natalie did. She's an announcer,
right? Absolutely not. Nobody wants to see that. Okay. So where to start? I think it's been really cool to see professional swimming become more of a viable career path, at least certainly for more years than it used to be. And I think it also opens up a lot of great swimming where people, you know, are reaching their peak later and later, and you're able to stay in the sport that long, especially from the women's side. It's like, you don't necessarily peak when you're 16, and now like women have the opportunity to keep doing it. Maybe I'm limited in my vision. I don't know if it's ever going to be, you know, a make it and swim till you're 30 and then you're set for life. But it's certainly, you know, you can make a good amount of money while you're doing it, which is great. And I think it's also fun to sort of see like the institutional knowledge among swimmers is sort of, I think a lot of it started with Michael, and then it's, you know, trickled down from there. And there have been more and more opportunities for swimmers over the last decade, for sure. And so, you know, you have people like Nathan Adrian that have been in the sport for a long time, who's really savvy and really smart about his branding and the partnerships that he has. And he's just a really awesome guy that people want to work with. And so he's managed to make this work, you know, in addition to being a really incredible swimmer. And he's now kind of turning around and helping the next generation coming up of, this is how you think about getting an agent. This is how you partner with brands. Like all of this institutional memory that now makes the next generation of swimmers have it a little bit better. So, you know, that's been great. And I think it's also fun to see like the impact of the athlete partnership agreement start to pay dividends for Team USA. And like, we're better when people can eat and like pay for all the stuff that they need to do without worrying, and you can buy good food, and like all that stuff is covered, and you're going to get a performance boost out of it. So it's been good to see those things come up. To your question of whether the ISL made me consider coming back into the sport, no. What almost made me do it was the FINA Champions Series, which was obviously in response to the ISL, where I would have been able to just show up and make money as the, you know, Olympic champion from the previous iteration. The unfortunate part was that I was out of the testing pool for too long, and so I didn't have enough window to like be in the testing pool for 9 months before we did that. So, but I would have embarrassed myself in a 200 backstroke with no training in order to get that cash.
Yeah, and you don't want to be that one who shows up and doesn't make the qualifying time.
Yeah, no, I can't have standards. I just need to be able to finish legally a 200 backstroke, which I think I can still do.
Yeah, that's not good for your brand.
Yeah.
I had a follow-up question, because when you're talking, I wanted to know if you have any parallels. The last 4 years, you've been, you were McKinsey, you're an engineer, you solve problems. McKinsey pulled you up as they normally do of engineers, and you worked there for a couple of years. Now you manage a portfolio, for a philanthropy company. what are parallels do you see with the work you do there, where you're trying to help a lot of, I'm assuming, nonprofits and NGOs around the world for many things, trying to just help them in many ways, environmental, socially, what have you. Mm-hmm. You work with USA Swimming Foundation as well, and talking about the trickle-down effect of how swimming, like how can we help the swimmers? And let's think of the international perspective, because I want to take it out of the States for a second. You know, like ISL is the way, but how do we really trickle that down to the other organizations and LOCs and FINA? How do we get it to beyond, you know, like the parallel you're doing with your work with the King Philanthropies? Is, do you see any at all? You solve problems. What's the suggestion? More outreach by USA Swimming? You guys are the lead. We follow.
You know, that's an interesting question. I don't know if I'm going to have a great answer to it, because I honestly think more of it, like USA Swimming is a nonprofit, but it does think of itself, and with Tim Hinchey's kind of mindset, you know, thinking of itself as a business and making sure that it's lucrative and growing its revenue streams and all that stuff. So I think the parallels would be more suited to
knowledge, not money, but knowledge. Like the trickle down effect of knowledge. Like the trickle down effect that, like, you're in charge about of team proposals and grant and handing out grants to organizations, and you validate those, and they have to meet criteria. What about if there was a knowledge extension? And we have so much medium right now for that. So, you know, and there's a way that you could trickle down knowledge in the right way. You can make sure it's also followed up properly. So it's not just a one-time clinic. We did a clinic a couple months ago in Trinidad. I would love to have followed up and see what happened out of it. Just like you make a donation and the organization has to follow up with metrics and deliverables. Why don't we have something like that, you know?
Yeah, no, that I think is actually the one thing that tracks. And so, you know, we're all about proving that interventions work. In our work, we want to see randomized control trials and make sure that, you know, the intervention that somebody's paying a lot of money to deliver actually delivers the benefits. And, you know, it weirdly doesn't happen as often as you think it would. But, you know, I think that's how you solve any problem, right? Is,
of course,
do you have the feedback? Do you know that the effort that you're putting in is going to pay off? And I think there's so many interesting questions right now with how do we grow the sport? What makes 12-year-olds drop off when they do? Because we see a huge drop off in the membership base from 12 to 13, as a lot of youth sports do. But, you know, it's looking at trends that are happening with our work and, you know, trying to help people in extreme poverty. Climate change is a huge thing. You have to look and be like, what are the things coming down the tracks that you have to be aware of? And in USA Swimming right now, there's tons of both interesting and really scary trends happening in youth sports that we need to be looking at and make sure that we're addressing and reacting to, and hopefully doing it in a proactive manner instead of just trying to you know, staunch whatever damage may happen because of it. So I think there are certainly some parallels, but, you know, even with the question of diversity in our sport, which is a huge stain on the sport of swimming. And I think we, especially the sport of swimming, has just a really tough history with that. And I think as we see what's going on in the country and we look at what our sport looks like and it doesn't look like the rest of the country, and you try to think about what are the barriers to it? Is it as simple as they don't have pool access in their neighborhoods, or is it more complex where there's some, you know, social pressures and dynamics there that you have to work on with sort of a more messaging marketing campaign to change attitudes? Maybe it's a five different factors that matter, but it's not as simple as, you know, nothing in the world is ever as simple as let's do some trainings and, you know, make sure that people's minds are changed. You have to really do the hard work of understanding the problem before you can go about making a sensible solution to it.
I don't know
if that answered your question.
No, it did, but it answered many questions. Do you think that's why you're still so heavily involved in the USA Swimming Foundation and you still have your brand of a swimmer? Because you want to try and give back more to the sport and the people? I don't know.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, I think we just did our first round of interviews for the next open seats on the board for USA Swimming, and getting to talk to athletes that are applying, everybody has this sense of like, the sport of swimming changed my life. And I had so many of my most formative experiences through it. USA Swimming helped facilitate many of those and sort of, you know, represents the sport of swimming in the United States. So how could I not want to make sure that more kids continue to have those great experiences? So that is absolutely what drives me. And then with the foundation, I think it's as fundamental as, you know, it's not just that I had a good time in the sport of soccer and I want to make sure other kids get to play. It's that if you don't know how to play soccer, you die. Like that's not, that's what we're dealing with swimming. And there's just so many levels why it matters and why it's important that it becomes so much more widespread throughout the country.
We talk about opportunities and equality. I'm curious, as an elite female athlete, what your thoughts are about how we do things like the gender gap with swimming coaching. We have there's the token kind of, you know, woman coach on a college staff in a lot of places. Yeah. You see a fair distribution at the club rate or at the club rank, but not so much in college swimming. As an elite woman in the sport, both as an athlete and observing the coaching ranks, what are your thoughts on what needs to happen? Like, do you think we're in a good spot?
No, I don't. I think looking at some of the stats and the sort of funneled pipeline of what the gender ratio looks like in the coaches, the USA Swimming level, it's exactly as you said, Brian, where you've got coaches at the club level, but even there, there's a pretty significant drop off between like the younger novice swimmers, many more female coaches at that level. And then when you get to the senior club level, that drops off significantly. So you're already sort of winnowing the pipeline even before club to college. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, within college, it's a really time consuming job. Like the time that you're away from your family, you know, with Greg and Tracy, Greg goes to Colorado Springs 2 weeks a year after being at NCAAs for a week. And, you know, Tracy goes for a lot of that, but she's able to bring her family now. And just, I think, being cognizant of what you are asking coaches to do and making sure that works for everybody, I think you lose a lot of coaches. And then, you know, to be able to be a head coach on the Olympic team, you have to really have been an assistant coach on the Olympic staff at some point, or the head coach of Worlds or Pan Pacs or something at that level. To do that, you have to be selected to the staff. To be selected to the staff, you have to have had WUGS experience, you know, junior team, other trip experiences. And with those, you're asked to be away from your family for 3 weeks sometimes. And that's just really, that's a big ask of people. And so I think you see at every stage, there's ways that really talented coaches can drop out. And then, you know, compounded with the fact that if you don't have enough people above you to say, hey, how did you do that? How did you make it work? Then you're going to lose some people at the bottom who just can't envision themselves sort of on that trajectory. And so again, like Luke, to your point, there's issues at every level. It's a super complex problem, but I think first step is like saying this is something we want to work on, and then also recognizing that the answer is not necessarily to just select more women and reach as far down as we need to get parity at the Olympic level. It's so fundamental in how coaching works in the sport of swimming.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to a swimmer from Barbados. She's now the head coach of Tulane University. Leah Martindale, now Stansel. And we're going to have her on the show soon. I'm looking forward to seeing how her progression was made, you know, because she coached under Nesty at UF and then how she got up there and where she's going and how she dealt with that. Because the more people, you're right, more people like her can tell her story and show how she did it. And at the same time, get support from NCAAs to allow certain, you know, things to happen in life. As we're seeing right now, we've all adapted to COVID. So let's adapt to be a more inclusive and diverse future. You know, let's power it by being proactive. So there's ways to do it. But
There definitely are ways, but like Maya said, there's so many, I think, issues, especially, you know, my wife's a swim coach and she is now gone because, and obviously it's COVID, so situation has changed, but she's coaching from 3 to 8:45 PM. And there's just so many dynamics where if you have kids and we don't have kids, but if we were have kids, you know, like you said, there's big gaps in that situation. Or if you're going to WUGS, like you said, there's 3 weeks being gone where I think, like you said, there's need to be an initiative to make it more acceptable and make it more common where there are situations and things that are set up to accommodate people that have families, whether it's male or female. Mm-hmm. So you can be gone for 3 weeks. And like I said, just help out and make it easier for everyone.
Yeah. And, you know, not necessarily that they're on the same level of an issue, but just the overall mental health and burnout among coaches, like male or female, it is so stressful and you're away from your family a lot. So I think being really cognizant of that too, where you have more men that are saying, hey, I don't want to be away from my family for 3 weeks. That's crazy that you would ask that me. That also helps.
Yeah. It's a man to speak up. It's whites to help speak up the blacks right now. It's important. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just talking to a guy that I work with just about how to create more diversity in our workplace, right? I'm hiring for a couple of roles right now. And so, of course, I've been reflecting on that. And, you know, he was seeking counsel from some outside folks who work in diversity at Airbnb and who've done a great job of navigating this. And it was, you know, the message we landed on was, well, you know, you just as the person in control of the situation, in my case, as a hiring manager or for someone in the swimming community as a head swimming coach or what have you have to make it a priority, first of all, that it's important to you. And you have to know that prioritizing things like building a diverse culture or workplace or staff is on par with other credentials that you've typically looked to. And so, and that may mean that the candidate pool, you have to be more patient with, to find the balance of things that you're typically looking for. And, you know, being realistic right now, when it comes to staffing and creating opportunities for women on the pool deck and to encourage that pathway, is that we have to prioritize that thought process. You know, and I think I'm just curious, as somebody who swam for Tracy, are there any women that were on the team with you that were interested in coaching? I mean, I think there were guys that I swam with, for example, that were interested in coaching. You knew for a while that they were, but it's easy for them to see that pathway. But I wonder if there are some really strong swimming minds and coaching potential within women that just gets suppressed because they don't see that avenue. And I wonder if any people like Tracy, people like Terry, I swam at Auburn with Kim Bracken and Kathy Searcy, Dave Durden's wife. And I was around some women, but what are your thoughts on the impact that has and how we change it?
I think that's a great point. And I never considered coaching, and I don't think anybody on my team did either, and I've never actually thought about that question before, which is, I think, a reflection of kind of, you know, we see Tracy and we love her and she's great at her job, but it just never occurred to me that would be something. And I don't know really of anyone that's come through the team that I since I've been there that has thought about that, which is tough. And I think you need to see more of that. And just kind of the more examples of it, the more it seems like it's not just that these three archetypes kind of can do it. There's a path for everybody. How you want to move through that, I think, is helpful and will draw more people in.
We wanted to bring Justin back in. There was a fan question.
All right, Maya, we have one question from Michael, and we're going to backtrack a little bit. Going back to 2015 Worlds in Kazan, what were the most valuable lessons you learned, and did those experiences at Kazan contribute to what you achieved in 2016?
2015 in Kazan, that was a really hard meet, just in terms of World Championships, the 400 IM is on the last day of an 8-day meet. So I swam the 200 IM on days 1 and 2, and then basically had to come back up and like get back into shape, do hard practices, and then taper again for the 400 IM. So in that way of just like staying focused on my meet while other things are happening around me was helpful. Russia is just a really tough place, and Kazan especially. And so like there were some food issues that we were dealing with, and just some, you know, being careful about what you can and can't eat, and how do you try to compete at the highest level when you don't have access to your normal diet. So just kind of being able to roll with the punches a little bit definitely prepares you for the Olympic Village, where you're not totally sure what you're going to get on any given day. And then I think I also had the experience of getting fourth in the 200 IM by just a couple. It was a small margin. And previously, like in 2013, I don't think I had medaled individually. And I was like, okay, that's fine. Like that's, you know, I swam some good races and had good times. And 2015 was the point where I was like, oh, I'm here to medal. And it feels way better to come back to the team area when you have a medal and you get on the podium. Versus like, that was pretty good. I got a good time, but you know, didn't really put points on the board for Team USA. So that kind of shifted my mindset of this is something that I have to really be prioritizing both for myself and for the team.
That's interesting. The pressure you have for swimming for Team USA and like swimming for Team Trinidad. If I made the Olympics, I was like, it was a hero. But some Team USA, if he made the finals, oh, good. Yeah. You know? It's like, hi guys, I just did best time by 10 seconds. Seven.
Yeah.
Shake hand. Like,
oh. It's wild.
Did you do that in the 53?
When I was 12.
All right, Maya, we got some rapid fire questions for you.
All right.
What's the hardest race in swimming?
400 IM.
Are nose clips cheating? All-time favorite snack at age group meets?
Costco muffins.
Olympic gold or world record?
Olympic gold.
If you could start an ISL franchise, what would you call it?
We're still waiting on a good name here.
Winston's Rockets.
Like the I don't know, like the Bay Area Vortexes. I regret that as soon as that came out of my mouth.
We need a team Bay Area. Yeah.
What's the worst part?
Or something. Vortexes.
What's
the worst part of puppy training?
The biting.
You met your husband when swimming at Stanford. Is swim cest really a bad thing?
It doesn't have to be. But it can go sour.
That it can. What's the number one thing that swimmers at the end of their career should be doing now to get ready for life after swimming?
Be reaching out to people in your life that have what seems like interesting jobs. That doesn't have to be anything necessarily in your field, but set up informational interviews, just get a better sense of what opportunities are out there, and how kind of different sectors work, and you'll be much better at sort of having a network to go to and understanding what various job opportunities are.
Preach. How freaked out were you during the Santa Rosa wildfires?
Pretty freaked out. Burned down some friends' houses.
How long till a woman goes sub 2 minutes in the two back long course?
I think by 2028.
That's pretty good. I feel like we're on the right track for it right now. So, oh yeah, nice job. Okay, so we're going to change gears and welcome another guest, Catherine Breed. Welcome back to the Social Kick Podcast, Kat.
Yeah, my skiing idol.
Hi, Maya.
Hi.
So, actually, Luke, why don't you enter this?
I just thought I'd have a Cal-Stanford rivalry. So you guys kick it off. Let's go.
First six person screen. We're getting close to Brady Bunch status here. Yeah.
Great.
No, Kat posted something on Instagram that caught our attention a couple of days ago, and an event that's happening tomorrow. And then about a week ago, Lee and Neil and Jacob Pebley started an initiative as well called Swimmers for Change. And I got my attention, our attention as well. And it just so happens that Kat's eventually posted it's happening tomorrow, and Maya is going to be on her episode of Swimmers for Change tomorrow. And tomorrow is Juneteenth, which is the commemoration of the abolition of slavery. So I just thought it'd be good for us to talk about that. I love to know, Maya, what got you involved? Why are you doing this initiative, Swimmers for Change? How is it helping the Black Lives Movement? And likewise, Kat, what's going on tomorrow in the Bay Area? And why am I going to be jumping in with sharks with you?
Sure. So I'll dive in first. I got involved because Leah asked me and reached out, and I was happy to help in whatever small way that I could. I think it's really important to make sure that the people who have experienced the problem right now are the ones speaking. And so I sort of want to be led where she and others want me and where I can be the most helpful. And I also think it can be helpful, you know, to kind of share my own personal journey and how my views have changed on this. And changed is a strong word. I think just, you know, become more aware. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in Northern California, and I think what I absorbed out of history lessons in my school is like, civil rights movement was a huge success. Racism is dead. It's all about socioeconomic issues now. And it took a lot of reading and conversations with people that I respect and that have gone through it to realize no. And I need to let others know as well, because it's not going to change if more and more people continue to be taught that. So that's why I'm involved. It's Nathan Adrian and Katie Draybot and I tomorrow, another Stanford Cal union, very sweet, us getting along across the bay. And we will be raising money for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and the Equal Justice Initiative run by Brian Stevenson.
What is the series happening? Like, how, what's the genesis of it? How did it come about? I know it's being backed by, just give us some more insights on Swimmers for Change.
Yeah, I think Leah and Jacob came together and they wanted to figure out something they could do in this moment and use the platform that swimmers do have if people are interested and just want to hear our views about swimming. If they're not even interested in these things, maybe that's an interesting way to bring people into the fold who otherwise wouldn't care about it. If people already care about it, then it's a great way that, you know, maybe we can get them to donate some more money. So I think it was a good combination from them of taking what skills we have right now and trying to use them in some small way to address the problem. Because I think a lot of us are feeling like we're there, we want to help, but not doing something is not an option. And this is one small thing. It's not gonna be the end of what we do and how we get involved, but it's somewhere to start.
And are you going to start by putting on a wetsuit, grabbing your husband, driving 20 minutes north after your podcast and jumping in a Quartet Park and splashing around with Kat? Kat, what's going on tomorrow at 5, at 6 p.m., 5:30? What's going on?
Yeah, so at 5:30 tomorrow, myself and a few Southend members are co-organizing a swim out. So it's kind of like a paddle out, but you're just going to be standing, floating. You can paddle if you want. And we're going to hold 8 minutes and 46 seconds of silence. And that's just a space for people to be uncomfortable and to be with their thoughts and to kind of decide and reflect on how they want to show up and how they want to be allies. Because I mean, swimming's white. It's a really white sport. And I think it's hard to know, like Maya, how you said, like, should my voice be one that's being heard right now or should I be listening? And I think it's really important to be educating myself and learning and having hard conversations with my family and friends who maybe have different opinions. You know, but I do think it's important, like, for us to just commit to non-complacency and to speak up against racial injustices. Because I think for so long, like, being white, I'm afraid to say anything at all. And it's like, that's, we're done with that. Enough's enough. Like, it's time for people to speak up and say, you know, I'm here. And so tomorrow's really more about just us being there in the community and being together. And I don't know, and challenging people to be allies and finding ways to do that.
Well, we're very excited to come and join you.
I'm excited too. I think it will, I think it's going to be somber, but a really good energy as well. So, yeah.
We might still get in a few efforts after the fact. Maybe John's triceps have recovered by that point, and we'll do a few.
I don't have a wetsuit. I'm a little worried, but we'll,
John, you can borrow mine if you need it.
It's like 62 degrees.
Oh,
No problem.
All good. And like I told Luke, swimming yesterday for the first time in 3 months was just like all my regular swims. That's how it goes nowadays.
That's totally true. Also, my first triathlon in California, I had a weird thing happen the morning of. It was a 45-minute drive to get to the race. I got there. I forgot my wetsuit, and people and I was walking around transition going, does anybody have a wetsuit? Because if I went home to get it, I wasn't going to make it back for the race start. And they said, oh, it's fine. It's like 63 and you're going to be good. So, so it's a new calibration. Hardcore people like you, we'll enjoy being in the ocean tomorrow.
Yeah. And I meant to mention this, but we're also raising money for Equal Justice Initiative, Me Water Foundation, which brings at-risk youth to surfing and the Movement for Black Lives. So yeah, it'll be good.
Thank you both for being leaders. It's really a pleasure to get to know you and talk to you. Kat, I know we can follow you at Beyond the Black Line on Instagram. We're excited to see you tomorrow. Maya, where can people follow you?
I am at Maya Dorito on Instagram. Even though I've changed my name, I can't change my handle because it's just too great. And I'm on Twitter at Maya Dorado.
Awesome. Thanks so much for your time. And yeah, we'll see you. See you, everybody.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks. Next Thursday, we should have Katie Hoff on. So make sure you tune in and join us there. All right. Have a good day.
Cheers.
Bye. Bye.